Well, winter is on the horizon here. Our nights are drawing in and the fires are being lit again. Autumn has swung into full gear. For our next guest, winter is something to be embraced. It's when she's most in contact with the beating heart of things. A tree in winter might appear dead, but writer Catherine May points out in her much-appreciated book, Wintering, that in fact that tree is in bud. Wintering is an exploration of the literal and metaphorical winter, the cold, fallow time of year, and the dark seasons we all experience in life, where she says we can also find light, that suffering can lend an appreciation of the good things. Part memoir, part nature writing, Wintering offers tips for tuning into our lives, for accepting sadness and getting through it. A writer of fiction and non-fiction, published in The Times, Good Housekeeping and Cosmopolitan, Catherine lives by the sea in Whitstable in Kent in the southeast of England, from whence she joins us very late at night. Hello and thank you. I'm glad you're a night owl. So lovely to talk.
It's lovely to talk to you too. I'm actually not very much of a night owl, but I've been really happy to talk to you. I've got family in Gisborne, so it's quite exciting. Oh, I hope they're listening.
Wonderful, wonderful. So you've got the cocoa or something on the go to try and keep the brain fired up. As we said, there's no winter in Gisborne, by the way. It's just beautiful the whole year round.
No.
The wintering of the title,
I'm sure that's true.
As we said, is both literal and metaphorical. And how do you describe wintering in the personal sense?
Well, wintering's a word I've borrowed really from the world of nature to describe those times when you feel like you've fallen through the cracks. So it might come from, you know, a mental or physical illness. It might be a major life event, you know, a divorce, a bereavement, something like that. Or it might just be a change happening. But whatever that, you know, wherever it comes from, it takes us into this very similar place, which is this feeling of the world carrying on without us. And we're almost kind of looking out at it through glass. And I mean, it's such a painful time, and it's something that we tend to keep secret. We don't talk about it because we're embarrassed. We think we're the only ones it's happened to. I say we think we've uniquely failed. And I don't think that's true. I think it's a really normal part of the life cycle that we've made a secret of. And I think when we look at nature, we can see how those patterns repeat themselves across all of the natural world. You know, you mentioned trees in your introduction, animals hibernating, all of those things that we accept in nature, we don't accept in ourselves. And I kind of want to change that, really.
I love the way you describe it. I can't recall quite the word you used, but that's right, the world carrying on without us. You can feel like you're a spectator. You can feel like you're literally can be in a room and not really be participating in the conversations or in what's happening because you're off your own little world somehow and almost feel like a spectator to your life. At the time, typically how do we react? I mean, are we often, we know we feel like shit, excuse me, but do we often have the self-awareness of what's happening in these times, or does it happen afterwards sometimes?
I think it tends to happen afterwards. I think we're very bad at recognising when it's happening, and I think we're often trying to like rush our way through it, trying to get it over and done with, trying to find the one magic button that we can press that will make it all go away. And I mean, when you look back over those times, you realise that it just isn't that simple. And there's a certain kind of process you have to live through almost that can't be rushed. I think we recognize that most in grief, actually. You know, we know that when we're grieving, there's no hurrying it. You know, it's going to be at least a year of feeling wretched and feeling very distracted, like your mind keeps pulling you away into its own thoughts, and that's why you can't take part in anything very well. It's just this constant experience of being dragged into whatever your brain is ruminating over at the time.
The other time of winter that's particularly difficult is where there are multiple things perhaps happening at once and we get this cumulative effect. And there can be a certain helplessness. Part of what this book is a great plea for each of us is an ability to see the signs and then to recognise and therefore to be able to sit with or walk with what's happening. So what are the signs that whether it's one obvious event or just sort of a cumulative effect or perhaps a time of change looming that we're anticipating, what are the signs that we're heading into a winter and we need to, you know, gird our loins and get some good woolies on?
Yeah. Well, I think the signs are different for different things. But for, I mean, obviously, some things happen very suddenly and we're left having to deal with them. Like, we can't see those ones coming. But there are lots of situations where we live with stress for a very long time before everything crashes. And I write about that a bit in the book. I talk about, you know, feeling incredibly stressed in my job and not wanting to accept that I was past the point of coping. And it was only when my health collapsed that I had to drop out. You know, I couldn't go to work anymore. I was so ill. And I was kind of forced into it. And when I look back at that, all of the warning signs were there. Like, I knew that I was struggling, but I didn't want to think about it. I didn't want to look it in the eye. You know, I didn't want to do the planning or the kind of accepting of change. All of those things I fought against and resisted. And the problem with all of that is that it just doesn't work. You know, you might get away with it for a little while, but life takes over and, you know, it visits you much harder than it would have done if you could accept it early. So, you know, I'm not saying I'm the best person in the world at this, but I think I would love us all to get to a place where we could see this stuff coming a mile off and start talking about it early and start like actively going into the process of change rather than being dragged there, which is, I think, what we tend to do.
Could you speak a little more of your experience when you were younger and a depression you discovered at quite a young age, which I imagine was one of the most earliest and extensive experience of wintering that you had, and what you learned from that has informed your philosophy?
Yeah, I mean, I remember being depressed very, very young, but I really suffered very badly when I was 17. I had a total breakdown. I certainly couldn't go to school, but I couldn't really do anything. I couldn't eat, I couldn't talk, I couldn't look after myself in any way. And that was a real life or death experience, and it was terrifying. And I didn't think I was going to make it through that. And there was this very definite moment when I had the thought that actually I was surviving it. Like, I was actually getting through it. This weird survival instinct kicked in that was really based on very little. But I kind of rebuilt myself from there. And I, you know, I've got depressed again since. I'm a person that gets depressed. And, you know, I think loads of your listeners will know that about themselves too. But I think after that very, very extreme experience, I learned that there was a beginning and an end to it, that I trusted that I could get through it. I didn't feel fantastic throughout the experience, but I did know that there was a shape to those really brutal winters and that it was possible to endure them and to survive them. And that helped. It's not a big thought. It's not like, I knew the thing that would stop me from being depressed ever again. I wish I did. But it's more of a sense of like my own ability to survive and my own resilience, I suppose. I mean, that's what resilience actually is, isn't it? It's not smiling your way through things, which I think is how we often talk about it. It's really knowing that you can dig deep when you absolutely need to.
There needs to be a patience. You're right here. Winter had blanked me, blasted me wide open. In all that whiteness, I saw the chance to make myself new again. And this is another matter. Accepting that we change, the people around us change, our circumstances change, and preparing for those times. Also, this idea, and this is so, it's always been promoted by the media, but it's so exaggerated now with our Instagram and Facebook lives, that life is somehow this perfect progression of ever-increasing achievement and progress. Yes. It's no such damn thing.
Yeah.
And how,
no.
Again, realizing that there will be wins and losses and things you do that you regret and that are not your best self. accepting these and again being prepared for when they happen and then for what? For learning from them, for changing, for growing from them?
Yeah, all of those things together. But I think actually in general, being ready for them to be complex, I think, you know, you referred to Instagram and all of that kind of, you know, world that we inhabit now. And I love being online. I love so much about it. But I think one of the big problems is that they're spaces in which we can't be honest about the not even just the bad bits of life, but the boring bits and the bits where we're treading water and the bits where we've got nothing to say. And I think what I would love is to be able to accept how varied life is. And you know, being happy all the time isn't even desirable. It's a very flat state of being. I like it that I'm sad sometimes. I like it that I'm angry sometimes. I like that variation. I think it's part of my humanity. And I don't think that any emotion is ever wasted, really. You know, like all of that sadness is often really instructive. It tells you that something's not quite right. And it's really important that we learn to respond to those signals from ourselves rather than never letting ourselves hear them. And we should certainly stop jollying each other along all the time as if our sole aim is to just be smiling our way through it. Like, that's not what we want for our friends. We want our friends to feel like we're listening to them. And, you know, we spend so much time posting stupid messages on Instagram that don't help anyone. Like, I want more radical honesty in this world.
Humiliation or embarrassment, or as you say, just honestly saying, I'm not okay. I mean, this is the essence of human connection. Mm. This is why humans are social animals. We help each other out. But that requires a vulnerability and an honesty. And as you say, responding to those signals, because loneliness is the curse of our times. It is, you know, one of the most painful, almost, well, actually physically painful experiences that we have. But again, recognising, accepting it is the first step to, okay, what do I need to do? How do I need to take some risks and establish some connection here, including the fact that some of my efforts might fail? So these emotions, whether it's grief or whether it's loneliness, these emotions in these painful times are also about us identifying what we need and taking action.
Definitely. And like, on one hand, I think we're all always just doing our best most of the time. We're just trying really hard. But that doesn't mean to say we don't still screw up. And it's okay that we screw up. Like, you can't live your whole life without ever making a mistake. I mean, I'm trying to teach my son this at the moment. He's 8 and he finds it really hard to admit he's been wrong. And I think it's okay when you're 8, but when you're 48, it's really time to change. Because actually, how do you grow? How do you improve anything? Like, imagine if we did that on a societal level, that nobody ever admitted that they'd just screwed up and said, oh, sorry, I'm going to try and be better in the future. It's okay. There's nothing, well, there's very little that you can't make better again. And it's always fine to be sorry and to have regrets. I don't really agree with this idea of a no regrets culture. I don't think it's very helpful. I think regrets are so useful for us, actually. But they don't have to come with self-loathing. That's the difference.
Where were you at just before you wrote the book? Because it was another one of those winters. It was another one of those times where things happened all at once, that stressed one. And you write of your husband's, you know, urgent dash to hospital when his appendix burst. Then it was you finding out that you had an illness as well, and worries about finances. So, you know, at the stage before writing the book, what was that particular winter and what was so illuminating about it?
Well, I tell you what, the funny thing is, the stage before writing the book, I thought I was going to write this book about wintering from the kind of sunny uplands. You know, I thought I was going to look back over all those periods in my life when stuff had gone wrong and like draw some wisdom out while everything was going well. And it was almost like in the act of imagining the book, I rained down disaster on myself. Like, everything went wrong at once. And so actually I wrote the book through that, you know, I think that's part of the power of it in lots of ways, that you get that immediate sense of what it's really like to live through that without the distance. You know, I kind of talk about my moments of anger, my moments of paranoia. But yeah, we went through a very uncertain time. You know, my husband had a life-threatening, very sudden illness, which was terrifying, just at the time when I was leaving my job. And then that was hastened because I became really ill. I ended up with all sorts of gut problems, which I didn't have a couple of years ago, and now I live with them permanently. And then my son became too stressed to go to school anymore, and we had to withdraw him from school for a while because he just wasn't coping. And so the three of us like fell through the cracks together for a while. We all went through this time of feeling very, very lost, very isolated, you know, feeling like outsiders and feeling like nobody else could possibly understand us. And it's been interesting ever since writing the book, because it's made me aware of just how many people would have understood us if we could have found a way to communicate it. And, you know, put our pride aside, like that's the last thing you feel like you have left when you're going through a really tough time, is you feel like you've got your pride. But that pride isolates you and cuts you off from getting what you need. And, it stops us from handing wisdom down. We could be teaching each other so much about this life that we all have to learn the hard way. And I've got big regrets about not reaching out about all of this sooner, really.
Catherine May is our guest. We're talking about her beautiful book, Wintering. You're listening to 9 to Noon on RNZ National. It's 23 minutes past 10. The book's organised in months leading up to and through the Northern Hemisphere winter. Why arrange it like this? Is this because winter gets incrementally harder or just incrementally more intense?
Yeah, I think winter's got a narrative arc, actually. I think there's a definite going in period. There's that transitionary period, which you're probably in about right now, I'd say, where you're beginning to sense winter coming, but it's not quite there yet. And there's that sense of apprehension. The nights start getting darker, all of that kind of thing. And I wanted to express something about midwinter, you know, that absolute midwinter point of despair. And what was really interesting as I researched that was that British culture used to really acknowledge that midwinter moment. There were, you know, festivals all around that point, festivals of light, where we were deliberately bringing light and life back into the world to acknowledge that darkest point. And, you know, we'd have felt it more keenly at the time without electricity. And I realised how much of that we'd lost. You know, there's Christmas, certainly, and the big run-up to Christmas. But after that great big bang of a festival that actually makes us more exhausted than renews us quite often, there's nothing for a long time. And there would have been all these bridging moments through the season that would have helped us to find a rhythm in the most difficult points of our life. And yeah, it's really fascinating to think about the shape of winter. And then there's a definite moment when we're coming back out of it again and we need to ease back in slowly. You know, these things can't be rushed. So yeah, I tracked it through the months for that reason. But I had a lovely message from a reader in Australia today to say that she had penciled over all of my, you know, Northern Hemisphere months with the equivalent Southern Hemisphere months, so that it made more sense to her. And I think we should probably issue stickers.
The other thing of winter is the cold. Now, talking about embracing the cold, for the book, you visited the Blue Lagoon in Reykjavik in Iceland with your son. And was this about saying, OK, what is it with the full embrace of the cold?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been drawn to the north. I travelled to Tromsø in Norway when I was heavily pregnant. You know, and whenever a holiday opportunity comes up, my first opportunity is always like somewhere cold. I do love the cold. I love snow. I even enjoy rain. I love walking in icy landscapes. But to me, I think Iceland, it represented a lot of things. It represented a very isolated culture where they've found their own way to get through winter. And I wanted to find out like how you make that really happy, welcoming culture. And so, yeah, we travelled over. I was very poorly at the time, but my doctor sort of said to me, like, well, you know, you only live once, get out there. And yes, yeah, swam in the Blue Lagoon, which my son absolutely loved. You know, saw all that amazing volcanic activity, which is really unfamiliar to me in England. But then I came down with a fever and proper flu while I was there. And I kind of had this time in Reykjavik when I was just lying in a bed, sort of thinking about the world. But like, even that was helpful, I think. I learned a lot about my limits in Reykjavik, and swam in very beautiful water.
It's the extreme of our feelings, again, to come back to the metaphor, and you don't want to do it all day, every day, but the extreme of those feelings can be quite thrilling, and was in the case, you know, the release of endorphins and hitting the cold. But you mentioned also the relationships again, and no one was bothered about being in the nutty, and no one was bothered about whether they'd been to the beautician either, from what I read. And there's a kind of, an honesty to that, and not trying to, you know, always present one's perfect self. You mentioned earlier the festival. So another place you went was to go to Stonehenge for the winter solstice. And what was it? There's only ever 6 weeks. You're only ever 6 weeks away from a festival in paganism.
That's right, pagan festival. Yeah, in the sort of druidic or pagan wheel of the year. There's a new kind of celebration or a marking of a moment of change in the year every 6 weeks. And yeah, so I visited like one of the ultimate ones, which is midwinter at Stonehenge. It's a bit changed from ancient times, actually. When the henge was new, you would have watched the sun set through a certain formation of stones on the night before. But those stones have fallen down now, so we watch them rise the next morning. and I was really curious about it. It's not the kind of thing I go to normally. I'm not, you know, I don't have a faith or a practice like that. But it was actually fascinating to watch everybody celebrating a slightly different thing there. There wasn't unity in that sense. It wasn't like going to church that everyone was sharing a common purpose. But there was a commonality in that everyone was there to mark this really key important moment when the light was coming back, and to feel joy even though it was cold and dark, and actually the sun didn't come up properly because there was so much cloud cover. You know, it just got lighter and we were all kind of like, yay, I think it's happened, you know. It was that kind of experience. And it really convinced me of the value of finding ritual in your life, of finding ways to mark those important moments, and actually just figuring out what those important moments are, because it's so easy to miss them when they come, and to just make the year a very kind of spiritually bland experience, except for Christmas and maybe Easter and maybe a summer holiday. Our ancestors found a lot more to celebrate than that, and I really think we could find that again.
What have you learned from the Japanese about micro seasons?
Yes, they have. There's a few more, but around about one season a week, and each one marks a very specific change in, you know, like something like a new flower blooming, an animal coming out of hibernation, or a different thing that happens. So these really small shifts in the year, and what that helps them to do is to stay engaged with nature, because I do think that once we can tune into what the natural world's doing, we get a sense of something bigger than us. And, you know, it's not always nice to feel small, but sometimes feeling small against these massive movements that are happening regardless of our sort of feeble human lifespan, it is actually strangely comforting. I think we spend too much time thinking about ourselves specifically, and it's finding opportunities to think about ourselves as a kind of fragment of the wider world. I find that very comforting.
That connection to nature and our intimate place in nature is a recurring theme here. And I mean, just your sheer celebration of the winter season and wrapping up and getting out in it. But also how the animal kingdom deals with this. I was fascinated. Only three animals hibernate in the UK. Everyone else is out there getting on with it. And the bees story, we learn so much from bees. This is just lovely, how they survive the cold.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, funnily enough, I've booked into my first beekeeping course next week because I was so inspired by the bees in the book. I interviewed a really radical beekeeper, actually. He's set up a program in the UK where he puts beehives in school playgrounds, which is a really kind of counterintuitive thing to do. But actually, he's teaching the children how to, you know, you have to respect a bee because it will hurt you otherwise. And he's teaching the children that. But he described bees to me as wintering machines. He said that their whole lives are pointed towards winter. You know, we think of bees' main activity as gathering pollen in the spring and making honey over the summer. And actually, what the bees are doing, if the bees were able to articulate their thoughts, they would tell you that they're preparing for winter. And when it gets to the end of the summer, when the salt cold season come in, the bees, I mean, in a very brutal way, reject everybody from the hive that isn't necessary. And that includes all the male bees, unfortunately. They get stung to death if they're still alive. But then they, sorry, men, this isn't a pleasant thing for you, but I think we have to respect the way that then they hunker down in the hive. And in order to keep warm, I mean, obviously they've made all that honey to eat. That's what honey is for, it's to eat through the winter. But in order to keep the hive warm enough, they do this extraordinary thing, which is that they dislocate their wings. So it's almost like putting the car into neutral. And that means that the little motor, it's not a motor, but you know, the little bee motor that normally runs their wings, if they run it with their wings dislocated, it keeps the hive warm and they act as little heaters. And they take it in turns, they circulate through the hive so that the bees that are heating the hive are right at the center. And then when they get tired, they move to the outside and someone else takes over. And that means that a beehive reaches about 40 degrees centigrade all through the winter, which I think is absolutely extraordinary. And that's because the bees are just a busy keeping going all through that time.
I do love the chapter also about the wolf, and there are wolves among us, and you talk about how we've bred all our, you know, you're a domestic pet, so am I. We've bred all our edges off ourselves.
Yeah.
And people's personalities, you have to do all this stuff and, you know, walk through these times according to your own personality and your own setup. But you make the point that there's a bit of the wolf in all of us sometimes in our winters. And what do you mean here?
Yeah, so I was thinking about, you know, January when there's the wolf moon, as it was known in sort of Saxon England, which was the time when the wolves were hungry after a long winter of starvation. And that was the time when we'd see them coming out of the forest. And that was the time when they were the most dangerous because they were hungry enough not to respect the normal boundaries of the forest. So they were genuinely dangerous to humans then. And you know, there is a point in all of our winters when we are wolfish too. And, you know, when we're feeling starved and hungry and desperate and, you know, bitter and angry and all of those things. And that can be very self-destructive, or it can be a time when we behave badly towards other people as well. And actually, I wanted to write about, because I love wolves, you know, despite all of the dangerous parts of them, they're also really extraordinary at forming communities that are mutually supportive and that actually take great care of, you know, the weakest. And I wanted to think about how a wolf could be an element of what we are and just an acknowledged thing that we pass through, another part of that life cycle that, you know, we can have our wolfish moments. And again, like if we deny that about ourselves, that's when it becomes monstrous. You know, that's when our inner wolf becomes an addict, for example, or an abuser. But actually, we can accept our wolf and watch it and be with it and acknowledge it while it's present in us, and it passes. And you know, I've been a wolf several times in my life, and maybe several times a week on a micro level, and it's just an aspect of what I am. It's a, you know, it's my shadow self, as you might say, and it's not dangerous unless I start pretending it's not happening.
You see, this is it again. The whole overarching theme of this book is self-knowledge and self-love, no matter what the level of pain. And, you know, there's no miracle cures to a time of suffering or a time of feeling discombobulated. But boy, there are some really good tools that you have in here, really practical tools. Like, you know, if it's not something you can fix, don't waste time ruminating on it, you know. We want to be empathetic people, but we can't empathise for everybody all the time. We have to care for ourselves in order to care for others. And you've got some really practical ways of narrowing the focus during these times where a lot of our energy is on a time of pain or suffering or loneliness. And you know, what are some of those ideas?
Well, I think, I mean, and this is counterintuitive and it's almost a little bit forbidden, but I think you have to find the pleasures that you can during winter. Like, one of the parts of the sort of denial mindset we get into is often that we forbid ourselves moments of joy during those times. You know, we think we're not good enough to have them. We think we don't deserve them. We think we'll be somehow sort of betraying ourselves almost if we enjoy ourselves. And I seek out small pleasures that I can handle during those times. You know, so that might, I mean, for me, that means I spend hours in the kitchen cooking. I love doing that. I feel very soothed by it. And I think there's something there about keeping your hands busy so that your mind is occupied a little bit too, and deliberately distracting yourself. But also choosing your space where you do your reflection, like making sure that you're doing something that lets you reflect. You know, that might be writing a diary. For me, it's meditating. It's something that I've done for, I don't know, like 15 years now. And I find it absolutely indispensable for those moments of anxiety. Or, you know, like walking, swimming. I write a lot about cold water swimming, which I love doing. But whatever it is, it's about finding constructive space in which you can reflect and really acknowledge your feelings, but keeping moving for the rest of the time so that you're not paralysed by these awful feelings.
Also, slow down, get enough sleep, let your spare time expand, cut things from the schedule so that there is time both for the hard reflections, as you say, but also it's an acknowledgement of how much energy it's all taking and to look after yourself. Finally, you deliberately make yourself uncomfortable in order to find the so-called liminal space, which is this concept of the in-between and, you know, the no man's land. We're not quite sure what's happening.
Yeah.
We've gone beyond a boundary. And is this almost like a training for discomfort and a training for uncertainty that we can exercise a muscle over?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, yeah, so the way that I do that is by cold water swimming. And there's a lot going on there. I mean, yeah, you're right. One of the things that it teaches you is that you can endure discomfort on a really simple level. You know, that I mean, my friend said when I was swimming, which I wrote down in the book, that by doing a resilient thing, you make yourself more resilient. It's a really circular pattern, and you have to choose it in the first place in order to get that resilience. And there's something in there, I guess, about acknowledging that you are able to endure suffering. You know, it's like a metaphor. It's like living a metaphor for other kinds of suffering. But also, weirdly, a lot of these things that give us discomfort also give us an endorphin rush and give us a kind of high as well. You know, like people going out running, which I can't do because my knees are terrible. You know, all of these different things that we do that on the face of it look too tough and not pleasant at all. And the people that get the most out of them find them deeply unpleasant too, but keep going anyway, because it gives them much more than just those unpleasant feelings. It gives them this sense of their own resilience, of their own survival, and it releases fantastic chemicals into your blood that make you happy just for a little while.
There's so much humour in here too, Catherine, so many lovely events that happen and moments that happen that cause the reader to laugh. And again, it's indispensable humour wherever it's found. It's a beautiful book. Thank you very much again for standing up so late. For staying up so late.
Oh, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
Catherine May, the book is Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times.